Hey, podcast listeners. This post-it note I'm holding tells me that you are listening to yet another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Madigan, and I get moderate to extreme enjoyment from examining the intersection of psychology and video games. In every episode of this podcast, I interview experts about the psychology of video games and share it with you here. This is the episode about why the war on violent video games may be wrong. Listen, do you hear it? In the distance, in the background? Yeah, it's the incessant klaxon meant to warn people about the dangers of violent video games. It's been going on like that since about 1976, when somebody noticed that the arcade game Death Race 2000 let you run over little pixelated people. It went on like that for a while, then certain senators and interest groups really cranked it up during the 1990s in response to games like Mortal Kombat. Violent video games make kids violent, people claimed. They warp morality and provide step-by-step instructions on how to commit carjackings and mass shootings. Efforts to legislate away violent video games have failed, but that klaxon is still going. What's more, it's not just alarmists and concerned parents that are cranking it. Klaxons have cranks, right? Let's just say that they do and go with it. A lot of psychologists and other academics have tried very hard to study the problem and have come to the conclusion that video games, especially violent video games, are harmful. The klaxon's still sounding. But maybe it's time for it to stop. That's what my guests on this episode of the podcast think. They are two psychology researchers and experts on violent video games who have just released a book and argue why they think the war on such games is wrong. They explain why we're so predisposed to blame video games for real-world violence, why proving that link exists is so difficult, and some of the personal and professional beef that gets thrown around by researchers studying the topic. While they're at it, they take the time to talk about other often cited perils of gaming, such as addiction, misplaced morality, physical activity, and more. So stick around for just a few seconds and we'll get to that. First though, my financial advisor wants me to mention that this podcast and the psychologyofgames.com website in general are supported by awesome people like you on Patreon. Patreon.com/POG makes it stupidly simple to kick a buck or three my way so that I can keep making podcasts and writing articles. All right, on with the interview. Well, thanks everybody for joining us on the interview portion of the podcast. I have one returning guest and one new guest. We have Dr. Chris Ferguson and Dr. Patrick Markey. They are the authors of a new book called Moral Combat: Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. Sounds like a book that has a definite position, and we'll talk to them about that in this segment of the podcast. So thanks for coming on, guys. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be on.
So why don't you just start us off by explaining who are you and what are you doing here?
Sure. I'm Dr. Patrick Markey. I'm a professor of psychology at Villanova University. And Chris and I have a book coming out, as you said, called Moral Combat, which basically tries to examine myths as well as the science behind video games.
I'm Chris Ferguson, and I'm a professor of psychology at Stetson University, and I think Patrick pretty much covered it. He did a pretty good job.
Okay, so you guys are both psychology PhDs and active psychology researchers too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is the book about, Moral Combat, and kind of who did you write it for?
Sure. It's a book that's written for basically the general audience. So it's written for gamers as well as parents who might be concerned about video games, hopefully politicians too, and maybe other researchers who might have been potentially misled to what science says and who wants to understand better how video games may affect us or may not affect us, without the sensationalism that usually comes with this topic.
Right.
Yeah, I think we've been in the field for, you know 10 years or more, maybe 15 years. I think it's one of the things we see quite a bit are kind of these hyped up headlines about, claims of one sort of effect. Sometimes those are negative effects. Sometimes those are positive effects. And, oftentimes the claims that we're seeing made by news media or politicians or other groups, really didn't match some of the real research data that's out there. So we were kind of hoping to sort of set the record straight, as it were, and do so in a way that was kind of fun to read at the same time. And hopefully that's what we accomplished.
Yeah, I've read at this point, I have to confess to probably only have read about 2/3 or maybe a little more of the book. But the tone of it does seem like it strikes a pretty good balance between being approachable, you know, like anybody could pick this book up and read it. But you don't shy away from talking about, you know, the science as well, and talking about research and using that to inform your points.
Yeah, we have, I mean, in the book, there's well over 300 references to academic journals and things of that sort. So it definitely has a science focus, but we also, you know, have a good couple of fart jokes here and there. So I think we do strike a pretty good balance.
I think three, I think I counted so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not right. Yeah.
So what is it otherwise that's different about this book than other similar books or summaries on the topic? Like there are violence in video games is a hot topic. A lot of people have written about it. A lot of people talked about it, either, you know, books and chapters or articles. What is different about what you guys have put together here?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that, you know, at least in my impression, there really kind of are two other groups of books sort of out there. And those are, there's a group of books that sort of written for, you know, the general audience, you know, the general reader and such. And then there's a group of books that are written by scholars. And my impression is there's not a lot of overlap, you know, mm-hmm. between those two groups. So, you know, a lot of the books that are kind of written by or are written for general audiences are not necessarily written by people who know a lot about what's going on in the research field. They may know some, but, you know, they're not necessarily insiders. And then, of course, you know, a lot of the books that are written by scholars tend to be a little bit dusty and dry and not terribly, you know, approachable. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we were kind of hoping to write a book that would be, you know, like I said, kind of like fun to read with the fart jokes and kind of the inside little, you know, bits of humor and the Easter eggs and that kind of stuff. But really still kind of speaking to, the actual data that we have about video game influences, you know, things like aggression and addiction, but also positive stuff like, you know, cognition and stress reduction and things like that. And, in a lot of cases, kind of popping some balloons, you know, probably on both sides a little bit, but also kind of highlighting where maybe there are some things that, you know, we are finding there's some evidence for, as well as evidence against. So, you know, we really kind of wanted this to be kind of an insider view of what's going on in the actual research field, but in a way that, you know, someone that didn't have a PhD, you know, in something could still enjoy reading and not feeling like they were in school while they were doing so.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that distinguishes it too is kind of what Chris was saying, was that typically there's the academics written by people who do research in the field, the non-academics, and very often the academics will overhype their results and the non-academics will take them for their words. Mm. And I think what Chris and I try to do in this book is we kind of show the underbelly of what really goes on in our research labs. And Chris and I do this research too. So in some ways we are criticizing our own research of the problems that happen in the labs, sometimes the imperfections of our measurements, sometimes the weak, how we try to generalize lab experiments to school shootings, kind of those problems that, since Chris and I have been in the area, we kind of are familiar with. We try to, like I said, show that underbelly of what's not always super pretty in science.
Yeah. So I think a good example of what you guys were describing is one of the earlier chapters where you talk about the grand theft fallacy, and sort of how people engage in faulty thinking and faulty information processing around the concept, the topic of violence in games. Can you kind of walk me through the grand theft fallacy? Like, what is that and sort of what topics fall under that concept?
Yeah, the grand theft fallacy is basically the notion that people have a tendency to blame video games on tragedies. That they'll instantly suggest that because a perpetrator might have played a violent video game at some point in his or her life, that that must have been a contributing factor to typically the crime that they committed. And there's all kinds of examples. I mean, this is most prevalent in the media. So whenever there's, you know, some kind of horrific tragedy and it happened to be an adolescent male who happened to be around 16 or 17 years old, who most likely had a video game console, suddenly they jump and say, aha, it's because he played video games. And we see that over and over and over again with really no evidence to suggest that that is what really happened. And I mean, what we call this in psychology is an illusionary correlation. The idea that sometimes we think two events are correlated to each other because we only get half the story. So when an adolescent male who happened to play violent video games commits a crime, we point out, oh my gosh, he played violent video games and he did this crime. But when a person commits a crime and they don't play video games, we never point out, adolescent male commit a crime and he never played a violent video game.
Right.
Nor do we point out all the times that the millions of adolescent males and females who play violent video games don't commit crimes. And so we just remember those very salient pieces, and we create in our minds this false sense of what reality is. Kind of like goes along with that is we also tend to remember parts, bits of information that confirm our biases. So if we think video games are related to violent crime, we'll be more likely to remember when we hear a story about that, as opposed to when somebody doesn't play a violent video game that also committed a crime.
Yeah, that ties into lots of different, you know, biases and in the way that we think about the availability heuristic. If something is sensational and an interesting story, then it's easier to recall from memory, and thus we tend to overweigh how prevalent we think it is in the world or how frequently it tends to happen. So this sounds like a good application of that broader concept.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good, you know, example of this in action was, you know, kind of thinking back to the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting that happened in Connecticut. And, you know, that really kind of unfolded as a real good example of this, because the state of Connecticut really kind of locked down their investigation and really didn't release any information for about 11 months until they finally came out with their official investigation report. So for, you know, 11 months, all people could do, you know, in the news media was speculate, and there would be, right, you know, a variety of these, you know, articles that would come out, and they would claim that they have some kind of like inside source, you know, an inside source close to the investigation claims that the shooter played, you know, tens of thousands of hours of Call of Duty Online and racked up, you know, thousands and thousands of headshots and blah, 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 blah. And it turned out in the end, finally, when they came out, you know, at the end of the investigation, 11 months later, you know, probably like most males, he probably at some point picked up a violent video game or two. But for the most part, he played Dance Dance Revolution. I mean, you know, which is, right, so there was, and I always kind of wonder, I mean, I still do, like, who are these official people supposedly close to the investigation? Because the official investigation report, you know, pretty much exonerated video games as a cause of that particular shooting. But it was interesting to see how, without any information about whether the shooter played or didn't play video games, you know, and assuming because he was 20 years old, we probably would assume he probably did play some violent video games. Yeah, but people kind of made these conclusions that video games were at least one part of this horrific shooting, you know, when it turned, you know, and they didn't bother getting any actual information. That wasn't necessary. People just kind of came to the conclusion without worrying about actual data.
Yeah, so every time there is a mass shooting, which is far too often, the headlines get made. And like you said, a lot of times the video games are brought into it because it sort of confirms people's expectations. And then to kind of change gears a little bit, the American Psychological Association also fairly recently made some headlines along those lines with the report that they put out about violence in video games. And you guys discuss that head on in the book and talk about it and talk about some of the issues that you have with the report in particular and with the APA, American Psychological Association in general. So kind of what is your beef with the APA and the report that they put out? And I guess, you know, we could say that I think at least Chris, you're a member, maybe Patrick as well. I have been a member of the APA in the past as well. But what is your beef with them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm actually, I'm a fellow of the APA, and I'm also currently serving on their Council of Representatives, of all things. So, you know, I'm fairly wound into the APA to some degree, at least. But yeah, I mean, the APA has a history of releasing, and they're not the only one, you know, only group like this, but they have a history of releasing really bad policy statements on things like media effects and media violence and video game violence that are not very well representative of, you know, what the actual data says, and oftentimes tend to be produced by task force or committees that look like they're stacked with people that have pretty hardcore a priori views about, you know, the issues. Kind of like, you know, if you were to put a committee together about whether pornography is harmful, when you put a bunch of like Catholic priests on your, you know, on your committee, right, they may be acting in good faith.
Or I mean, porn they may stars, be yeah, to be fair.
Yeah, in fairness, that's true. But, you know, they may be acting in good faith, you know, but they're not necessarily a really balanced, you know, group of individuals in terms of, you know, producing a, you know, nonpartisan, objective, you know, view of what the data actually, you know, says. And, you know, and the AP has this kind of this history of being really sort of non-transparent about how it goes about these things. So, like, is one story I sometimes tell, they originally sent this sort of group email out to maybe like 20 or 30 different scholars in the field, you know, just kind of suggesting who ought to be on this task force. And most of them went to scholars who had historically been anti-game, you know, who had made pretty exaggerated claims about games. And although I was included as well. And so I wrote to the person who was in charge of sort of organizing everything and said, hey, you know what, you really ought to probably, you know, solicit views from a wider range of scholars that are a bit more balanced. And the only thing they really did is in further emails, they used blind carbon copy. You know, that was the big change that they made. So we could no longer see who else was being emailed.
Yeah.
And so they actually reduced transparency rather than, you know, increased transparency. Now, that's only one little, you know, that's only one little detail of what, you know, went on. But that was kind of like the vibe of the whole, you know, recent, it was 2015 is when they kind of finished their most recent task force. It really was a sort of non-transparent, it looked stacked. The committee was old. I mean, you know, and there is data suggesting that age is related to opinions about video games. So it really looked like the whole thing was put together in order to kind of have this preconceived outcome about video games, you know, being bad. And I think that's because we have to remember that a group like the APA, and again, you know, I do have this kind of insider view of how they work a little bit, but they're a guild. You know, they exist not to give us objective facts, but to promote our profession. And that's why the three of us pay money to them every year, is to promote our, for them to promote our well-being. So something like this, you know, jumping all over this kind of an issue because it can help its members get grant funding and help them get newspaper headlines. It can help them get, you know, prestige of various sorts. You know, the APA themselves are going to get prestige working with people in Washington. And the APA loves, you know, being on Capitol Hill. Again, I've seen some of that, you know, firsthand as well. So, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily bad faith, although, you know, again, that particular task force seemed really non-transparent, and maybe it was kind of hard to see, you know, good faith in a lot of the things that they were doing, but I think they're acting more or less like a lobbying group. You know, they're lobbying for the profession, and doing so in ways that are not giving us good information that is objective and neutral.
And I think one of the biggest issues that I have with just the statement itself is that it gives this kind of false sense of consensus. That as a group, us all as psychologists are endorsing this, but we're really not. It's really just a very small committee of people, as Chris said, that are usually kind of a little slanted one way. They're usually the most vocal video game researchers. And they're the ones that are essentially speaking for this entire group. When we actually look at the changes of how researchers feel about video games, for example, like in 1984, there was a survey that found about 90% of researchers thought video games might actually be a real cause of violence. But recently, in a survey done by one of the most anti-video game scholars, he found that only really about 35% of scholars would endorse the idea that video games are a major cause of violence. And so we see this dramatic decrease in what researchers are willing to say about violence in video games.
So is this a generational issue where younger researchers are going to have different opinions and viewpoints simply by virtue of having grown up with games or grown up with people who play games?
When we look at the current scholars, I think that's definitely happening. In fact, in the book, we use this analogy of Star Wars throughout one of the chapters there's like this old established, you know, empire, and that's kind of the older researchers who have been around for years, who have been, you know, way back with rock and roll music. Some of them were suggesting that it was and now they just moved to video games. And so they're kind of just doing their same thing. They just changed media.
Yeah.
But you have this younger group of recent PhDs and some grad students who are very clever. They grew up surrounded by media. They understand it better. They're not scared of it. And you really start to see them kind of addressing this larger, well-established group. And sometimes it becomes kind of a brutal fight between some of them. I mean, some of them really are putting themselves out there. They're much more courageous than I ever was at that age. So I think it's definitely a generational shift or issue that's happened.
It's That's one of the interesting things I found about the book was how you guys talked about how personal some of this stuff gets sometimes, and the kind of shade that gets thrown around within, you know, the academic and scientific community. And you talk specifically about Andrew Shabelsky, who I've had on the podcast before and who I love seeing what he's up to and what he's tweeting and writing about. That sort of inside baseball, I thought, was something unique that you guys had to offer that I really hadn't seen before.
Yeah, the funny thing is, you know, sometimes you kind of think this is a field that at least ostensibly is supposed to be concerned about aggression, right? In a way, kind of like the underlying aggression, you know, message is that aggression is bad and we ought to be, you know, providing better role models for our children so that they're less aggressive. But then the scholars in the field are some of the most aggressive, I think, to some extent, that you know, I guess, you know, scholars in general can get pretty snippy, as the old kind of saying goes, that, yeah. the fights are worse when there's so little to fight over. But, but it is amazing how bad role models, you know, some of the scholars have been. If there is this kind of, you know, underlying sense of, you know, non-aggression is a virtue and we ought to be providing better role model for children and stuff, you only need to look at some of the writings, you know, by some of the scholars and see how, you know, aggressive, you know, the field has been. And not really even just in terms of, like, you know, criticizing method or criticizing individual studies. A lot of that stuff is fair game.
Well, that's science, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's really kind of like smearing people's reputations with, like, a broad brush and, you know, sort of insinuating, you know, sinister links between scholars in the video game industry and, you know, referring to people as being the equivalent of Holocaust deniers and all this kind of good stuff. So it's, you know, as Patrick was saying, I mean, you know, particularly for young scholars getting involved in the field, I mean, it's got to be, you know, quite intimidating to some extent to, you know, sort of jump in and wade in with some new ideas when you can be pretty assured that people are going to bite back, you know, in sure. terms of defending these kind of older ideas about, you know, kids today with their music and their hair and their video games, which has kind of been the way things have been.
Yeah. And in many ways, the title of our book, Moral Combat, really exists for those two reasons, that there's the obvious link of it with the morality of some people thinking video games cause violence and things of that sort. But there's also this almost inside baseball morality that I think happens in our scientific circles of where some people are pushing agendas more than they are pushing science. And it's both those fields, both those areas think they're equally right. And so there is this battle that actually happens within the halls of academia. I mean, we're a bunch of nerds, so there's nothing super exciting happening, but it kind of is this, the title really does encompass these two worlds, I think.
Yeah. And now a quick word from our sponsors. Well, my sponsors. Not really yours, but you know what I mean. All right, just as you expected, we're back. Now let's get on with the rest of the interview. So I want to move on to some of the benefits of gaming that you guys talk about in the book. But before we do that, the title of the book is, you know, Why the War on Video Games, Violent Video Games is Wrong. Can you give me the short version of what you argue vis-a-vis the bad effects of violent games?
I think the for me, the biggest take-home message, and the thing that struck me the most in doing this research and reading other people's research, is the fact that actually the link between video games and real-world violence, if anything, seems backwards. That we consistently see links between popular violent media and decreases in violent crime. So when popular video games are released, we actually see decreases in homicides and aggressive assaults. But this isn't true. This isn't just true for video games. It's true for all media. When violent movies come out, there are decreases. When violent television shows would come out, violent crime would go down. And so there might actually be a benefit to violent video games.
Is that the midnight basketball effect, where the idea is you're just getting people off the streets?
Yeah, it's almost boring, the explanation. I wish it was more sexy, but probably, I mean, so the data are what the data are, that no matter really how you slice it, whenever violent media is released, if you look at release dates, popularity of games, annually, monthly, any kind of change, you almost always see this decrease in violent crime, almost any kind of violent crime. And you're absolutely right that the reason why it might be happening is because it's simply targeting the people that are most likely to be perpetrators of violent crime and the victims, which are adolescent males. And they happen to be the ones most interested in video games. So instead of being out on the streets and bumping into each other, They simply are going inside of their homes and playing Grand Theft Auto or so. So mom and dad might not be thrilled about it, but in some ways you're separating victims from perpetrators by having them play video games. And the great thing about it is, you know, it costs zero tax money. It targets the group that's most at risk. So it is this ultimate crime prevention tool potentially that exists out there.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out, too, that the issues about hype over negative effects extend to other areas as well as the violence. So, I mean, probably people may be familiar with hearing like the headlines of video games are like heroin and kind of this idea that there's this, you know, massive wave of zombified kids who are addicted to video games. And that's really another concept that we discuss in the book that's really been kind of hard to pin down. And There doesn't seem to be the evidence for this idea that there's this massive wave of addiction occurring with video games. And, you know, even sort of the concept of what video game addiction is has really been hard to sort of pin down, despite really 2.5 to 3 decades of research on the topic. I mean, even to the extent where there probably are a couple people here that overuse video game here and there that overuse video games. The evidence seems to suggest that oftentimes they had some sort of pre-existing problem before the video games entered the equation. So, there are multiple areas really where we've seen this kind of like hyping of the dangers of video games. You know, the violence issue, the addiction issue. There are probably a few other issues like obesity and such. And certainly we would agree that, you know, parents want to keep some eye, don't want to be a free for all. But parents need to kind of manage this with other things their kids need to do. But there doesn't seem to be this kind of like impending danger, you know, behind video games. It's not like handing a bunch of cocaine to your kid and seeing what happens, you know. And that's kind of the way it gets presented a lot in the news media.
Yeah. Okay. So great. So one of the other topics that you touch on in the book maybe is admittedly sort of a preliminary topic, not a whole lot of great research done on it, but I thought it was really interesting. Maybe for selfish reasons, because it's a question that I get people asking me all the time, which is what research has been done on video games and morality? Like, do games enforce morality? Do they make people behave in moral or immoral ways? Do people take moral instruction from video games? What did you guys find out there?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite as simple as what people are either hoping or maybe hoping isn't happening. That I don't think there's a clear link between, like, you know, you play Grand Theft Auto and suddenly you think that's the way that like morality works in the real world necessarily. The evidence that, you know, is coming out of some of the studies of video games and morality, and it is very preliminary. There's not a lot out there, and there's a scholar, Matt Grizzard, who's been doing a little bit of research on this particular area, but What seems to happen is with, you know, kind of the darker games like the Grand Theft Autos of the world and that kind of stuff is that, you know, for a lot of players, they actually tend to create a kind of moral reflection. So people don't like play Grand Theft Auto and kill a bunch of prostitutes and police officers and then think, well, this is the way the real world works. It does get them thinking about, you know, these types of issues. Okay, I've been in a game, I've been doing these things. You know, how does this relate to the real world, and what does this say about me and my morality? You know, and in some cases, it really ends up being a source of this kind of positive moral reflectiveness. You know, people are kind of trying to, you know, I don't know, I don't want to overhype it again. We're all trying not to overhype stuff, but people are kind of really kind of thinking about like where their morality is and where it should go, but in ways of trying to make their sense of morality a bit more sophisticated. So it seems that a lot of these games can result in moral reflection, but in a way that seems on balance to be good, you know, rather than, you know, necessarily bad.
Yeah, I mean, and kind of going off of that topic, the study that Chris is talking about, what they had subjects do is they either played a shooter as a UN soldier, as I recall, trying to save people, or as a terrorist, you know, trying to kill people. In both of the games, you're actually playing the exact same game. The only thing that changes is the skin, is are you a UN soldier or are you a terrorist? Mm-hmm. And so there's the exact same level of violence. But what they found was the people who played as the terrorists actually had more moral reflection about their behaviors and their actions afterward.
Interesting.
And so the argument goes, therefore, it might create kind of this internal moral dialogue, that it kind of creates this guilt feeling, if you will, that we might strive to, you know, obviously we're not going to become terrorists, but you might strive to overcome, you know, feeling that emotion again. But as you said, it's very new. It's very preliminary. But I think what it really speaks to is that video games can be very complicated sometimes, that it's not just if you look at blood, you're going to become more aggressive. There are these nuances of our psychology that maybe blood might make some people more aggressive, but maybe it might make some people more morally reflective. That it's unclear. It's not a simple one size fits all, that games might affect people slightly differently. But I think it's important to point out that there's really no evidence to suggest that as a whole, people are negatively affected by violent media.
Okay. So how big an issue is game addiction, and what did you encounter when you were, you know, researching that topic and writing about it for the book?
Well, it's certainly a big issue in the sense of, you know, of course, a lot of people are talking about it at this point in time. And you know, and at least casually, I think, I've sort of been observing that this is an issue that seems to be maybe replacing the violence issue a little bit at kind of the forefront of people's concerns about video games. And you're absolutely right. Of course, you know, what we mean by addiction can vary from one person to another. And, you know, I say that I'm addicted to chocolate, but I haven't, you know, been whoring myself out for it yet, you know, but we'll see how, you know, things go. So I think there is a lot of sort of casualness, you know, in the term and the way that, you know, right. It has been used, you know, in the field, and a lot of real confusion about how to define this as a concept. And what basically happened is people kind of took like symptoms that fit well for things like heroin use and just kind of moved them over to video games and assumed that they would work well. So I think one of the examples we use in the book is kind of this idea of like there's a symptom for addiction that is I use X in order to make myself feel better when I'm stressed or feeling down. Now, if X is heroin, I totally get it, right? I mean, this is bad, right? But if X is video games or scuba diving or riding your bicycle,
taking a walk, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a bad thing necessarily, and so there's a lot of confusion, you know, even in the sort of like the DSM with its proposed category for internet gaming disorder. There's really a lot of like awfulness, you know, in it in terms of its, you know, potential to really pathologize a lot of normal behaviors. And so I think this, again, it's an area with a lot of hype. You know, why video games? Why not sex addiction? Why not food addiction? Why not exercise addiction? Why not work addiction? There's so many other things that people can overdo to some extent that it's really not clear why groups like the American Psychiatric Association or the World Health Organization are focusing in on video games when the evidence base is so, you know, mixed and poor, in many cases, poor quality. You know, there's evidence that this concept, you know, of video game addiction isn't very stable. It goes away by itself. And most people that have it, it's not connected to impairment in the real world. It's not connected to psychological distress very well. Mm-hmm. So it just seems to be a thing that some people have more than others. And it just seems to be that people that get diagnosed as addicted to video games mostly just play more video games than people that sort of don't have this, you know, that aren't high in this concept. So it's really a thing people worry about a ton. But in terms of there being like a really good database behind this that suggests this is a real thing that we need to worry about as a big societal problem, that sort of platform of data just isn't there yet.
So did other addictions start off in a similar situation, though, before bodies of research amassed and they did have sufficient evidence and criteria for considering it to be an addiction?
The only one that's actually official in the DSM, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that sort of defines all the mental illnesses, is gambling addiction. So that one's been in there for a while. I'm not even sure exactly when it first ended up in the DSM, but it's been there for quite a bit. And it's the only of the, you know, of the behavioral, so-called behavioral addictions, it's the only one that's an official diagnosis you can be diagnosed with. All these other ones like sex and exercise and work and, you know, food have all just been kind of like hovering in people's consciousness, but they're not official diagnoses. There's lots of studies on them. You know, there are in some cases, like with food and sex addiction, I think there are more studies of those concepts than there are video game addiction. But nonetheless, for some reason, you know, groups like the American Psychiatric Association and World Health Organization really haven't focused in on those things. They focused in on video games in the last decade or so. And again, it kind of raises the question of, you know, why are these groups, you know, so focused in on video games and not these other things? And it raises again kind of the idea that perhaps there's some sort of political pressure at play. In fact, one of the people I talked to at the World Health Organization came right out and said that, you know, they're responding to political pressure mainly from Asian countries, and that's his quote, not mine, you know. So there does seem to be some politics that's getting played, you know, even in this concept of, you know, video game addiction.
And one thing building off of that is that, I mean, as a science, we're an empirical science. And so at the end of the day, we want numbers and what do they represent? And recently there's been this large scale study that came out of Oxford, thousands of people, cross-cultural, and they examined the criteria that basically the DSM uses for video game addiction. And using this criteria, they found that people who had recently played video games, about 3% of them met criteria for being addicted. And initially that number sounds very disturbing. That's about the prevalence of alcoholism. And so that could be a big thing. But then when they looked into it of what are the actual problems that these people have if they're, you know, quote, addicted, what they actually found is very similar to what Chris said, that there is absolutely no difference between people who are addicted and those who are not addicted in terms of their social relationships, in terms of their personal, their own mental health, in terms of their physical health. The only difference they could find is people who are addicted to video games play more video games. So, I mean, it almost appears as if even if we use basically the DSM criteria, we're worried about something that doesn't seem to really be a problem. That, again, there are people who have problems with video games, like there are people who have problems with any kind of thing that might be somewhat entertaining. So we can always point to a person, but this is no different than any other activity we might engage in empirically when we look at the actual data. And so to me, that's what becomes most convincing here, of that addiction for video games is not the same thing as, you know, any other addiction that we've examined before or that we are worried about.
Okay. So what's good about video games, guys?
They're fun. They're entertaining.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, what more do you need? They're entertainment. I mean,
time.
That's what you
need. I
need
time at the end of the day to play more video games.
Some people are emotionally moved by them. So, you know, they certainly could qualify as an art form. So you can be moved emotionally. They're just like any other media, that they're simple fun sometimes. They're obnoxious other times. Sometimes they can move you. Sometimes they can give you new thoughts and so forth. But I mean, I think that at the end of the day is that they're just a media. That when I watch a sad movie, it's not really producing anything in me. I might be sad. I might have this emotional reaction to it. It might make me, and that's what I'm enjoying. But I think it's important to note, if I watch a sad movie, I'm not suddenly going to be clinically depressed by it. And games are much the same way, that they evoke these emotions and they might be temporary. They might make us feel a little aggressive right when we're done playing it, or a little bit happy, but they're temporary emotions. They're not changing the core of who we are, that they're simple entertainment. And I think that's enough.
Yeah. And I think when we talk about like the positive effects, and we do kind of talk about that in the book too, is sometimes the same issues come into play that, you know, we've seen kind of dramatic claims about, like, you know, video games will make you smarter and prevent your Alzheimer's disease and, you know, and all kinds of other stuff. And I think we do have to be careful there too, of, you know, we do talk a lot about exaggerated hype about, you know, violence and addiction and things like that. But there's also probably some exaggerated hype about things like, you know, video games boosting your IQ, you know, preventing grandma's Alzheimer's disease or something of that sort. I mean, probably, you know, the one area where there seems to be some, you know, a pretty solid research base is that this idea that video games, you know, including violent video games, can reduce stress, you know, but there's with a lot of qualifiers. So that's true only for people who like video games, you know, not surprisingly.
Right.
You know, and that doesn't mean that video games are different, you know, as Patrick was saying, you know, from a lot of other things that reduce stress. There's no magic bullet, you know, that video games have, you know, for stress reduction. They do seem to work for people who like games, but in the same way that, you know, crocheting works for people who like crocheting and stuff, you know. Patrick and I would probably end up plucking our own eyes out if we try to crochet, but, you know, so it wouldn't work for us in terms of reducing stress. So, but and video games are kind of the same way, that, you know, it's going to work to reduce stress for people who like the games. It's not for people who hate video games. You know, and I think that's really, you know, the main positive, other than, as Patrick was saying, they're fun, they're art, they're moving, and so on and so forth. And perhaps one risk sometimes parents want to think about a little bit is that, you know, for a lot of kids, games are stress reducing. They're also social. So they're one way that kids interact socially with each other. And, you know, taking the games away for particularly for long periods of time may actually come with some negatives, you know, that the parents may not foresee, because they think they're taking away toys. And what, in fact, they're taking away is this kid's opportunity to reduce stress and to hang out with their friends and socialize. Mm-hmm. So there again, it just takes a little bit of thinking in terms of, you know, what parents really want to do with some of these issues.
So the name of the book, or the subtitle of the book, is Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. What kind of research and results would motivate you guys to write a follow-up to this to say, you know what? The war on video games was actually right.
Stop buying our first book.
That's right. Now this one. But yeah, you know, seriously, like what types of results and what types of psychological studies and methods would it take to convince you that there is a problem?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's going to be different for Chris and I, and it might be different for us on which day you ask us too. That for me, a lot of it really does come down to the real world violence. That as a researcher little dark secret, I was a researcher who used to examine the negative effects of violent video games in a laboratory. And so what convinced me the other way was the consistent research that was coming out about real world violence. And so if suddenly we found whenever a Grand Theft Auto got released, homicides dramatically increased instead of decreasing. Instead, if we found that when people are playing certain games, we see changes in homicide rates. And this is controlling for other variables. You know, this isn't just a straight correlation. We're trying to control for any other variables that might explain it. Then I might start to pause, because I mean, that's basically the research I think is most convincing about the real world effects of violent media. So for me, that's what it would be. It'd be a fundamental change in what we see of the relationship between any form of violent media and real world violent crime.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Patrick said. In terms of like thinking about, obviously there's that body of research on sort of real world violence. I mean, a lot of what gets hyped, of course, are these sort of laboratory studies of relatively minor acts of aggression, the hot sauce and giving ice water or, bursts of white noise and this kind of stuff. So, yeah, some people might say, okay, well, there is no link with violent crime, but maybe with like little minor acts of aggression, there is some link. And here too, I mean, the evidence base is really inconsistent and not very high quality for the most part. And I would say that honestly, I think that this horse has been beaten at this point. I think this field is done. In the sense of after 3 decades, if this is all we've got, then I kind of think we've got our answer. But I mean, in terms
no,
of
no, no, we move on to virtual reality next.
There is that. Oh no, that is absolutely true. I mean, that's going to be the next big thing, of course, is virtual reality. But there again, we have to sort of start all over with that, because that's a whole different, that's a whole different form of media. And having just had the pleasure of getting to play some virtual reality games, it's super, it's awesome. But it is, arguably, fairly different from conventional video games. So we have to kind of start all over. And what we need to do is kind of like learn from the awfulness of 3 decades of really like poor quality research on video games in general, and learn from those mistakes and really kind of move towards like open science principles, much more transparency,
right,
using standardized aggression measures, because that's not what we've done in the past. We're making sure our aggression measures are well validated with real life, behaviors, which is not what we've done in the past. Pre-registering our studies so we can't monkey with our statistics to get the results we want, which is not what we've done in the past, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, there are clear lessons to be learned, even for these kind of like minor laboratory aggression studies. There are clear lessons to be learned from what went wrong with 3 decades of, really poor quality research on video games. If we're going to not like do it all over again with virtual reality, rather than having 3 decades of a mess, let's do it right, and really employ some rigorous scientific principles to studying this new media.
So there's a lot more about everything that we've discussed so far in the book, but I feel like we should start wrapping it up. And one question I always like to ask is, do you guys have time to play any games? Have you been playing anything lately? Anything violent or otherwise?
Depends on how you define violence. What is a violent video game? We didn't really talk about that. We don't even know what a violent video game is. That's another thing. But I've actually been playing, and it is true. I have a job that involves writing about video games a lot, and of course a family. that I want to spend time with, and other various hobbies and stuff. I don't have a lot of time to play video games, actually. But the one I'm playing right now, and it's a little bit old, but I'm actually playing Hearts of Iron 4. Okay. So I'm taking over the world as Nazi Germany, basically.
Somebody had to do it.
So it kind of brings up the question, I don't know off the top of my head what the actual, it's probably like E10 plus. I mean, very mild in terms of its graphic content, game. It's basically like playing Risk, essentially in video game form. But I'm playing as Nazi Germany, sort of overtaking the world, doing horrible, horrible things. So does this count as a, quote unquote, violent video game or not? It's kind of an interesting question to kind of ask.
And I'm a bit of a dork. So I have classic arcade machines in my house and everything. Nice. So I like old games, but I also like my PlayStation VR, whatever comes out on it. There's not much that comes out on it, but I do like it.
Not yet.
And not a whole lot. And then Overwatch, of course, like everybody else in the world.
Yep.
So kind of the standards. Yeah.
What cabinets do you have in your house?
I have a Pac-Man and a Dig Dug are my two main ones. And
classic.
I have a main cabinet that has lots of goodies inside of it.
Yeah.
So yes, I am that house on the block.
Yeah. Very cool. The cool. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad you think so.
Yeah, I've been playing Overwatch too. That's sort of my go-to. I've got, 30, 40 minutes to kill or need a break and play some of that. If I can pry my daughter off the computer to play it, because she also plays tons of Overwatch, and she's now to the point where she's much better than I am. So
always a scary point.
Yeah. I've been playing Horizon Zero Dawn. You guys heard of that?
Wonderful things. Yeah. It's about dinosaurs.
Yeah, open world post apocalyptic game. It's really great. I just got sucked into that, and I love open world games. And like last night, about 11 o'clock, I hit the point where it basically said like, "Hey, you're about to start the final main quest line. So go do all your side quests." And then I was like, if I start this, I'll be up for like another couple hours at least. So that's like waiting for me tonight.
You haven't seen your daughter anytime soon then, right? Since you've gotten that far in the game.
She's in the other room. She's playing Overwatch. She's fine. And then tomorrow, as of the time that we are recording this anyway, Mass Effect Andromeda should be arriving on my doorstep from Amazon. And I'm a big fan of that series as well. So I'm trying to finish up Horizon Zero Dawn so that I can move on to that. Although I've heard some sort of mixed reviews.
Animations aren't supposed to be so great in it.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. So we'll see. I'm sure I'll enjoy it. Just at this point, brand loyalty and love of the Mass Effect brand is enough for me, sad to say. But that's where I'll be spending my gaming time the next several weeks. So thanks, guys, for coming on. I'm excited for you about the book. Again, it's called Moral Combat, Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. And by the time anyone out there is listening to this, it will be available for purchase. I guess people can go to Amazon.com or wherever else they like to buy their books and find it. And you guys are Patrick Markey and Chris Ferguson. So thanks, guys, for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us.
Hey, one last question. Where would people go on the internet to find out more about you and your research? Any websites or social media that you want to share?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty easy to find me. I have a website, which is just my name, ChristopherJFerguson.com. Ferguson is FERGUSON. So ChristopherJFerguson.com. You can read. I think most all of my research publications posted there. You can download them for free if you have problems with insomnia. That's a real good cure for that. But I also write a little bit of fiction, so you can see some of my examples of the fiction I write there too.
Yeah, and you can follow me on Twitter at Pat Markey, or go to my website at patrickmarkey.com, and I'll be in both of those great places.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Great.
So congratulations on reaching the end of another episode of the Psychology of Video Games podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned something. If not, I've got many more episodes of the podcast and literally hundreds of articles for you to peruse at www.psychologyofgames.com. Go there to subscribe to the podcast, find me on Twitter or Facebook, and generally have a good time. It's all free, and thanks to my supporters on Patreon. So go to patreon.com/POG, that's for Psychology of Games, to find out how to join them. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next episode.